From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Dale Thronberry.
And good morning, America, and how are you? And welcome to Veterans Radio on this beautiful May morning here in Michigan, and we're excited to have you on the program. Today's program is going to be about a POW. Captain Gerald Coffey is going to be our guest, and he was a POW in Vietnam, and he's got a great story, and we're going to be talking to him in just a little bit. And then I've got somebody else here from the Richard Nixon Foundation who we're going to talk to. They're reenacting or having a reunion of the POW dinner that was thrown back in 1973, and many of us that are my age can remember that, where all the POWs were released in, I believe it was February of 1973, and they had a dinner in May, and I'm going to be bringing him on in just a second. But I just wanted to give you some news about one of our local veterans who passed away, and this is kind of it's harder than I thought it was going to be. But Mildred McGregor, who is the author of Frontline Nurse, passed away on Ash Wednesday at the age of 100, and her memorial service is going to be held today, May 18th at 1 p.m. at the First Baptist Church here in Ann Arbor. And Mildred was one of our first guests on Veterans Radio back in 2003 when we did a program on military nurses, and she was on the program with two other nurses, a nurse from Vietnam and a nurse from Afghanistan. And Mildred is well known, or was well known, in the Ann Arbor community for her community service. She was involved, as I mentioned, as a nurse. She was one of the first nurses into Buchenwald. She was nursed during the Battle of the Bulge, the Battle of Hugin Forest. She was in Italy. She was in Africa. I think one of her the funniest lines that she told me during our interview was that she said, as a nurse, she would follow the troops wherever they went. And she's just a wonderful woman, and she's going to be missed. 100 years old, Mildred. We want to thank you very much for your service, and our prayers and best wishes go out to the family. Her service again today is at the First Baptist Church here in Ann Arbor at 1 o'clock, and that's on East Washington Street. That's Mildred McGregor. You're going to be missed, Mildred. Thank you very much. Joining me on the line right now is our first guest, and as I mentioned, we were talking about that today's guest is a Vietnam POW, but there's a great program going on out in California at the Richard Nixon Library, and joining me on the line right now is Sandy Quinn, who is the president, and I'm going to say, of the Richard Nixon Foundation. Sandy, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you, and you are right. I am president of the Richard Nixon Foundation, which is out here in Yorba Linda, California, where it's beautiful today, too.
It's about time. Let's put it that way. Tell me about this great event that you've got coming up next week and next weekend.
The Richard Nixon Library Presidential Library and Museum is in Yorba Linda, California, and the 25th reunion of the Vietnam POWs was held here, and it was featuring all of the POWs who could gather. We brought Bob Hope, who was the master of ceremonies at the original dinner. We had Henry Holler, the White House chef, who prepared the meal at the White House. We tried to recreate the evening, and we had Dr. Henry Kissinger as the main speaker. The biggest dinner ever held at the White House was the one President and Mrs. Nixon held on May 24th, 1973, to welcome home the POWs and their spouses. They had arrived home in America beginning in mid-February. They settled in. They went through their debriefs. They went through their medical exams. They went home and met their family again. And then the President, Mrs. Nixon, decided to have an official American welcome at the White House. So they gathered, and they have periodically over the years. And this is the 40th reunion of that dinner, the 40th reunion of the POWs. Many of them feel it's probably their last. But more than 500 POWs and their families are gathering, and we're delighted, as the Richard Nixon Foundation, to be their host.
Well, I think it's a great opportunity, and for the public, too, because you have a lot of events going on this coming week. Could you tell us a little bit about some of those things? And they're open to the public, aren't they?
Well, not all of them, because we don't have room, but we're calling it the POW Welcome Home Week, and it begins Monday, May 20th, this coming Monday, when we have two-time Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld coming to formally open our POW exhibit, which we're calling an All-American Homecoming. And it features memorabilia from the dinner. It features those famous bracelets that so many of us wore in respect for the POWs. It includes the gown that Mrs. Nixon wore that night, the suit that the president wore. It has huge murals from the dinner. It has kind of a recreation of the set on the White House lawn where the speakers spoke and the entertainers entertained. And we're going to open that officially with two or three local POWs and Don Rumsfeld. And then on Thursday, and by the way, that's open to the public. And then on Thursday, May 23rd, the POWs are arriving at the library at 1 p.m. in the afternoon, Pacific time, and it's a 10-bus motorcade. We're welcoming them in our parking lot and on the front steps with a brief ceremony. We have high school bands. We have the great Patriot Riders escorting them. We have a police escort of these 10 buses coming down the freeway and down Yorba Linda Boulevard. We invite the public to come out and wave American flags and greet them. And then they're going to tour the galleries of the library, and we're going to dedicate a garden to the POWs and that dinner held at the White House in 1973. And we're having a program. We're having a flyover. We're having a number of military embellishments. And several people will speak, and we will present to them pins, honor pins, and certificates from the Department of Defense. And then there's an old-fashioned barbecue. And there's over 500 of them because they're bringing their families, too. Then on the 24th, Friday, in the evening, they're coming in black tie, just as they did at the White House 40 years before on that very night. And we have a dinner in our recreation of the East Room. And Dr. Henry Kissinger, who's 90 this week, wasn't able to come out, but he's been kind enough to do a tape for them. We have Congressman Ed Royce, who is chairman of the House Foreign Affairs Committee, and we're going to entertain them in style, and it'll be a recreation of that great dinner that the President and Mrs. Nixon did. Then the next day, on Saturday at 10:30 here at the library, we'll have a public panel. So the public is invited to that. Mm-hmm. And that includes a number of POWs, including Tom Hampton, who is a 9-month POW. He was an Air Force captain at the time when he was shot down. And he's chairman, president of the NAM POWs. And we have Everett Alvarez, Commander Everett Alvarez, who spent 8 years in the Hanoi Hilton, and a number of other POWs, and also Roger Shields, who was the White House coordinator of the POWs during the Nixon years. So it's a public panel, 10:30 in the morning. Ed Nixon, the president's brother, is going to be there as well. So that's open to the public. There's a lot going on.
It sounds like, and all those people out there in Yorba Linda are going to have a great opportunity to, especially you said on Thursday, there's going to be a great parade welcoming these POWs back home, and you know, you can never say welcome home enough to these men, I don't think. And I want to thank the Sandy, and especially the Nixon Foundation for putting this on. I think it's a wonderful opportunity for people to find out more about these men, I think.
That's right, and we're in a celebratory mood on this. Mm-hmm. This isn't really about the war. We're not revisiting the war. When you think back to the way these veterans were received when they came home, there was an awful lot of bitterness, not only nationally but in their hometowns. It wasn't a pleasant experience. But 40 years later, when people think back on the way the vets came home, the way the POWs came home, peace with honor, it's a time to thank them and salute them, and that's exactly what we're going to do. They're great American heroes, and we want to remind the country and indeed the world of their commitment, their sacrifice, their courage, their loyalty to their country.
Well, again, I think it's a great opportunity for people to come out and honor these men. As a Vietnam veteran myself, I want to thank you for what you're doing. It certainly is helping our 40 years later, but it's, you know, we're finally getting ourselves where we feel good about what we accomplished.
Yes,
over there.
Yes.
And I think this is part of that ongoing healing process that we've all been going through. And so Sandy Quinn from the Nixon Foundation and for the Richard Nixon Library, thank you very much. And for all those people
thank
out
you.
In California that are listening, go on out and honor these men. Thank you. All right, we will be back after a brief message with our guest for this morning. This is Captain Gerald Coffey, who was a POW in Vietnam in 6 years or longer, and we're going to be talking to him in just a moment. If you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call here at Veterans Radio. That's 877-573-7825, and we'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And welcome back to Veterans Radio, and we're going to be bringing on the air in just a second our guest for today's program. It is Captain Gerald Coffey, a Vietnam POW. But let me give you a little background on this guy. It's amazing. He's an author of a book entitled Beyond Survival, Building on the Hard Times, a POW's Inspiring Story. What I've got here is that Captain Coffey was born in Modesto, California, joined the Navy in 1957 after graduating from UCLA with a Bachelor of Arts degree. The thing that I find really interesting about Captain Coffey's story is that prior to Vietnam, he had already made a name for himself. In 1962, during the Cuban Missile Crisis, for those of you that are over 50 will remember that, as an F-8 Crusader pilot, he was awarded a Distinguished Flying Cross because he was the guy who flew low-level reconnaissance over Cuba, taking the photos that ultimately were used by the United States UN ambassador to prove the existence of these Soviet missiles that were there. He was featured in a 2007 History Channel series, The Man, the Moment, and the Machine, recounting that recon exploit. He's been mentioned in many books. He's been on the Military Channel and the History Channel, I think, all kinds of things. This is a great guy, and I'm looking forward to talking to him. Captain Coffey, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Hey, Dale, thank you very much. We finally put it together. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it is our pleasure. Yes, we have finally put it together. We won't go into the details of all of that.
Right.
We have to remember that Captain Coffey is in Hawaii, which is 6-hour difference time-wise, time zones away. It's like halfway to Vietnam.
That's right. Yeah, it's 3 a.m. here, but I've been looking forward to connecting with you, and the time actually is insignificant compared to my pleasure in getting you to spend some time with you.
Well, thank you very much. Well, would you prefer Jerry, or would you like to be called Captain again?
Jerry's great.
Okay, Jerry. Tell me about your story. Or let's go back here and let's talk about that. You know, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, which was, you know, a big enough deal, I think. You were a career Navy pilot, and you ended up going to Vietnam. And so let's talk about when you went to Vietnam and what happened.
Okay, and listen, I appreciate the opportunity to hear Mr. Quinn, Sandy Quinn, speak this morning and tell you about the event next week. And also, in that regard, I'd like to say that all of us returned POWs recognize that we received the homecoming that every Vietnam veteran should have received. The outpouring of warmth and graciousness and welcome was just overwhelming in some ways. Our release was symbolic of the closing of a very painful chapter for our country, and people showed it. And we just received so much of what every Vietnam veteran should have received upon his or her return.
Well, I think all of us that were watching you all come back were celebrating with you vicariously.
I think so. It was a national celebration, and we were very, very blessed to be the recipients of so much of that goodwill that was outpouring.
Well, so how did you get into that position to be welcomed home like that?
Well, I'll tell you, it was a long story, as you implied. After I was in the light photo squadron where I flew the RF-8 over Cuba, I had orders down to about 90 miles south of Jacksonville, where I'd been stationed there, to Sanford, Florida, which the home base of the heavy reconnaissance attack wing. And I went down there as a training reconnaissance training instructor based upon my experience in Cuba, and had a 3-year shore duty tour down there before rotating back to sea duty. And at that time, rotating back to sea duty, unless you were coming to the Mediterranean or the Atlantic, meant touring in Vietnam. And so I deployed, flew an airplane from Sanford, Florida, all the way out to the Pacific Coast and on to Hawaii, Guam, Wake Island, then Guam, and then to Japan. Went aboard the Kitty Hawk, which was already deployed out here, and flew about 2 months' worth of missions over South Vietnam and North Vietnam before my crewman and I were shot down over the central part of North Vietnam on February the 3rd, 1966.
And what type of missions did you fly?
We were flying tactical reconnaissance missions, mostly taking targets for the attack squadron stationed aboard the Kitty Hawk so that they could do their mission planning, and then post-attack coverage to show the damage that had been done, to damage assessment recon, to determine whether another strike would be necessary in that same target, and most of the time it wasn't necessary.
And what type of planes were you flying?
I was flying an RA-5C, a Vigilante, made by North American Aviation, which is just a beautiful airplane, long needle-nose airplane, looked like it's going Mach 2 when it's just sitting on the deck. And my crewman and I, it was a two-man airplane. I flew with a reconnaissance systems operator, and the two of us had flown together, and his name was Lieutenant Bob Hansen, and he and I had flown together and became good friends on that transpac, getting an airplane out there and flying combat missions together. Unfortunately, when we were shot down, I was captured immediately. He was killed, and it's not clear how he was killed, but he didn't survive that experience. I survived and was in a cataclysmic change for the next, embracing the next 7 years.
Right, and your co-pilot was kind of an ongoing part of the story. We're talking with Captain Gerald Coffey here, who's author of a book entitled Beyond Survival. It's about his 7 years as a POW in various parts of North Vietnam. And after you were shot down, what happened? Were you able to escape and evade, or were you picked up right away?
I was not able to escape and evade. I was picked up right away. We landed in the water in a small bay on the coast of North Vietnam, and we ejected at very, very high speed. The airplane was disabled and was not a controlled ejection at all. It was way outside the safe ejection envelope of the airplane. We ejected at 680 miles per hour.
How did I flew helicopters? So I mean, 120 miles an hour to me was excessive.
What
did that do to your body?
Well, it was pretty rough on it. I was knocked unconscious immediately by the wind blast leaving the airplane. And because we were rolling at the time we ejected and didn't have any choice in that matter, I had no control over the airplane by the time we had to leave it. And rolling the cockpit, which is a very heavy piece of equipment, skewed off to one side and hit my arm, broke my arm, my forearm, and knocked me unconscious. So when I regained consciousness, I was floating in the water, and I'd already inflated my flotation gear, removed my oxygen mask, which kept me from suffocating, and was in the water for several minutes, and were giving the North Vietnamese military and militia guys a chance to come out and pick us up, but we had no chance to escape, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and
so after we were picked up, then we were strafed by American airplanes in the Kitty Hawk. They didn't realize that we were already in those small boats that just picked us up. So, and the Vietnamese fought back fiercely. It was a pretty fierce battle for our capture, during which time somehow my crewman Bob Hansen was killed, mm-hmm. and I was fortunate enough to survive and then taken to the capital of North Vietnam, Hanoi, the capital city, over about a 12-day trip in a Russian-built Jeep vehicle. And then from that time on, we were in the North Vietnam prison system, most of the time in the old French-built, as the media dubbed it, the Hanoi Hilton, a Wallow prison, mm-hmm. Which was a block-sized prison. And Wallow means fiery forge in Vietnamese, and indeed it was a fiery forge.
Well, I've read the book, and I'm trying not to give the whole thing away because I want to make sure that everybody goes out and buys this because it's a fascinating story. But I do want to get some anecdotal things from you. When you were first taken into the Hanoi Hilton, what happened? I know you were probably isolated.
I was isolated immediately after being taken to my first cell and treated very roughly by the guards at that time, of course. They were trying to make an impression, and they did. Mm-hmm. I spent the first several months there in solitary confinement, and they looked at us as resources to be exploited for military information, of course, or for propaganda, which had another edge, which was the reason they kept us alive. So that was what I learned in my survival training, where they told me that no matter how they threaten you, they probably won't kill you because you do represent something of value. And they did look at us as resources to be exploited, and that's why they kept us alive. But the exploitation process wasn't all that great, but it's better than dying.
Yes.
So certainly we realized that we're fortunate in that respect. And so after a while, of course, whatever military information you would have had that they might have extracted became obsolete, but they always looked at us as propaganda resources. And they never, ever let up on that. And they'd always come up with new programs to try to force us to write letters of requesting amnesty or make statements condemning the war or, you know, soliciting the American people to oppose the war and mm-hmm. to work hard to bring it to an end because they wanted to come to an end to their benefit, of course.
Well, I mean, you know, looking back at you know, in hindsight, and you understand how many people that they lost themselves during the war, that they, you know, probably wasn't going to go well for them if it kept going and going and going, and they had to do something. And I just recently learned, not only from your book, from other sources, you know, is that there was this organized plan to, you know, upset the American public and get them more involved in trying to end the war.
That's exactly right. In a communist society, propaganda is everything, mm-hmm. and that which is public is sacred, and that which is done in secret, like the Paris peace negotiations, ultimately, are serious, and that's simply the way communism works. And they did. They realized that if they were to win the war, they were going to have to win it in the streets of America rather than in the jungles of South Vietnam. That's exactly the way it was. And, you know, at the end of the war, when we were released, we came home with our heads held high, believing that we had accomplished our mission and had saved the country of South Vietnam for its people to determine their own future. Mm-hmm. As it turned out, before it was over, during the next year and a half or 2 years, our political leaders in Washington snatched defeat from the jaws of our victory.
Absolutely. We'll talk more about that later on during the interview.
Right. Yeah.
I want to get back to your cell that you were thrown into, you know, when you were first in Hanoi. How big is this room?
Dale, it was tiny, in this particular, and the cells varied in size, but the cells used for the initial holding period were especially small, just for the negative impact it had on your morale. The cell was about 3.5 feet wide and 6.5 feet long, and had a concrete slab that jutted out from one wall, which was your bed, and at the foot of which was a set of ankle stocks that were wooden on the bottom, but with a heavy iron manacle that hinged down across the top and locked across your ankles. One tiny window very high on the back wall with a row of, double row of iron bars through which you could see the shards of filthy broken glass that were embedded in the concrete on top of the 16-foot wall that surrounded the entire city block-sized prison. Sanitary facilities were practically non-existent. You had a tin can, about a 5-gallon tin can that was your to take all your sanitary needs. It had no lid. And there was no military, there was no medical care initially for whatever injuries you might have had. I got there, and by this time my broken arm had fallen to huge proportions. But in retrospect, I was very lucky to be injured so relatively in such a minor way, because a lot of guys came in and were much more seriously injured and were tortured on top of their injuries, and in many cases didn't survive that routine right there. So he smiled, the English-speaking officer smiles and said, well, you've got a medical problem, you've got a political problem. When you take care of your political problem, we'll talk about your medical problem. So a little over a month after being shot down and sustaining the injury, they took me to a military hospital one night and set my arm and did a reasonably good job with it, as good as they probably would have done with their own people. My right arm curves off to the left a little bit, but I can do everything I want to do, and I have an excuse for my slice and golf.
I was going to say, you just have to kind of face, you know, to the left so it goes back to the right,
right
where you want it to go. I understand.
Exactly.
That.
Yeah. I can, a lot of people relate to that.
On a more serious note, how long did it take before you found out that you weren't there alone, or did you know right away that there were other people there?
I knew right away, because in the cell that they put me into, as kind of halfway in and halfway out of that 5-gallon can were some bloody bandages that I could only assume belonged to another American who'd gotten there just a little bit ahead of me. And then ultimately, then my first contact was with another American. I heard Air Force Colonel Robbie Reisner was one of the three senior men at the time, along with Jim Stockdale and Jeremiah Denton, who were all three of my heroes, because they exercised very positive hands-on leadership, especially in those more difficult early days where it would have been easier for them just to kind of keep their head down. But they didn't. They chose to lead, and they made set policy and initiated communication systems for us and with us and gave us encouragement. And Robbie whistled the tune Yankee Doodle out the window of the cell one day, and I heard that, and I clambered up to the open part of my window and whispered out to him that I heard him, and he said, "Want to introduce me to tap code," which enabled me to communicate with all POWs later on throughout the whole experience.
Okay, we're gonna come back to that tap code in just a little bit, because we're going to a break in about a minute and a half here. How long did it? You mentioned those stockades at the end of your bunk. Were you put in those every night or during the day, or how long were you shackled?
But it varied. One of my contemporaries there, Navy Lieutenant Commander Nels Tanner, who had embarrassed the Vietnamese terribly by using the names of Clark Kent and Ben Casey in a propaganda piece that he had been forced to write for them, and they used his statement in a slick paper propaganda magazine that got out into the Eastern Europe even. And when one of the peaceniks came to Hanoi and visited, and showed that magazine, they blew the whistle on Nels Tanner, Lieutenant Commander Nels Tanner, and pointed out to the communists that he had pulled the wool over their ears by saying Superman, who was supposedly his squadron commander, and Ben Casey was supposedly his squadron operations officer. So any Westerner that read that article would realize that Nels was pulling their chain. And when they found out about it, they slapped him into those ankle stocks. And he was in there for 2 years.
Oh, my goodness.
Before they let him out. They gave him mobile leg irons to walk around the cell sometimes and to go to and from interrogations. But he was punished for that with leg irons for 2 years.
Oh, my goodness. We're talking with Captain Gerald Coffey, United States Navy, retired. His author of the book is Beyond Survival. We're talking about his POW experiences of almost 7 years in the Hanoi Hilton. And when you come back, you can give us a call here at Veterans Radio at 877-573-7825. And we'll be right back after this.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Major Bud Day's F-100 was hit by ground fire, destroying his hydraulics and putting the plane into a steep dive. Details after this.
It's not easy being a veteran.
Coming back from Iraq or Afghanistan, I had been so excited to come home.
But it's harder than I thought.
Not everyone understands that.
Join us at communityofveterans.org.
Because no one knows what it's like to come back unless they were there.
Brought to you by Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Day ejected from his damaged plane. He smashed against the plane and broke his arm in three places. North Vietnamese militiamen captured him when he landed. When he refused to answer questions, they staged a mock execution and then hung him from a rafter by his feet for several hours. On his fifth day in camp, he untied himself and escaped. On his second night on the run, a bomb landed near the sleeping Day, leaving him bleeding from his ears and sinuses and sent shrapnel into his leg. Between the 12th and 15th day, he heard helicopters and stumbled to the sound. The choppers left just before he got to the landing zone. The next morning, he ran into a North Vietnamese patrol. As he limped toward the jungle, he was shot in the leg and hand and captured soon afterward. He was moved to the Hanoi Hilton. His untreated wounds were infected, and he suffered malnutrition. The fingers on both hands were curled into fists as a result of torture. He regained some motion by peeling them back on the muzzles of the guns and began to sing the Star Spangled Banner. The other men, including Admiral James Stockdale, joined him. They were released on March 14, 1973, and President Ford presented the Medal of Honor to both Day and Stockdale on March 6, 1976.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
God bless America, land that I love. Stand beside her and guide her through the night, breathe the light from above.
From the mountains.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're talking with Captain Gerald Coffey, author of the book Beyond Survival. And it looks like we might have lost him for a second. We're going to have to go back and get him. Anyway, we were talking to Captain Coffey, and he was just explaining to us what had happened while he was in the Hanoi Hilton. And a couple of the things I wanted to point out to him is that he learned this tap code. And when we get him back on the line, we are going to... Okay, Captain Coffey, back?
I'm with you again, Dale.
Okay. And anyway, I was just kind of going back over the story a little bit that now you were in solitary confinement. You were in this little teeny tiny cell. And you mentioned earlier on that you learned the tap code. Could you tell us what that is?
I will. The tap code was a way that we communicated during the entire time that we were there in Hanoi. And early on... the sixth man shot down, Air Force Captain Smitty Harris, had used that as a Boy Scout. And they realized early on, before solitary confinement was imposed stringently, that they were going to need to have somebody to communicate through the walls from cell to cell. So Smitty Harris taught the tap code to the other five guys, and they were like the pebble in the pond, and the ring spread out over the entire system. And it was incumbent upon every POW encountering a new man to teach him the tap code. Mm-hmm. Tap code was very simple, and it was very flexible. It was based upon 25 letters of the alphabet, throwing out the letter K because we could use a C in lieu of a K. It makes the same sound at the time. Arrange the remaining 25 letters in five rows of five letters each, one row on top of the other. If you were looking at me, and I would show that A through E was across the top row, and then F through J on the second row, and the third row of five, and the fourth row down, and the fifth row down. So that gives me a matrix of five horizontal rows and five vertical columns. In order to designate the letter that you mean, you tap first for the row that it's in and then for the column. So A is in the upper right-hand corner, left-hand corner, and so you tap first for the row, then the column. So A would be one tap, one and one. B is in the first row, second column over, one and two. C is first row, third column over, one and three. N is right in the middle of the square, the third row and the third column, so it's three and three. And, of course, Z down in the lower right-hand corner is the fifth row, fifth column, so Z was five and five. And that's basically how the tap code worked. It's a little bit difficult to see if you can't see a diagram, but it just served us so well. It's very, very versatile. Anything that would make noise, you could flap your clothes in that same kind of a pattern, 4-1-2-5, et cetera. And you sweep the floor. You could broadcast the entire cell block at one time, if necessary. And it was just amazing. I mean, we would spend hours on the walls with each other, giving encouragement and solace, and passing information. And we taught foreign languages through there. I learned so much French while I was there over the years by tapping from one cell to the other using tap code that. When I returned home and went to UC Berkeley pursuing a master's in political science, they gave me 2 years of credit just for the French that I learned through the walls of Hanoi using the tap code. And I was average. Everybody did it.
How did you, a question from Nina, our technician here. She said, how did they explain the tap code to you and decide to use it? How did they ever get this to you if you couldn't see them?
Mostly like Robbie Reisner did, he whistled a Yankee Doodle and got my attention, and I came up, and we were both whispering out the back windows of our respective cells.
Okay.
And so he was able to teach me the tap code. And one of my favorite stories is I was teaching another new POW the tap code from my window to his, and so I said, I'd already gotten his name and so on and other information. I said, you study it, and I'll let this little matrix scratched on your wall, and I'll call you up this afternoon, and we'll go slowly. We'll study it. So he said, okay, I'll study it. I'll be ready. So I call him up with my shave and a haircut tap, and expecting 6 bits in return. And instead, he misunderstood me and was whispering out his window into my window, 4-1-3-2-5-5-1-4-4-2-5. No, on the wall, dummy, on the wall.
I can relate to that. I was talking to another pilot, and maybe you probably did the same thing, is how we would relate frequency changes, whenever we were in the air, and we would say,
right.
go up from Babe Ruth, such and such, and, everybody knew, Babe Ruth was number 3, and that's where you went, and you just have to be creative.
That's right. And we were very creative in the use of the tap code, too. It was just amazing, amazing. And it was probably the single most important little system that contributed to our survival all those years in prison.
I think so. And I'm looking at Captain Coffey's book here, and I actually have a copy of the tap code here in front of me, a picture of it. And did you mention it? Did you guys scratch these into each wall of the?
Yes. If you'd be moved fairly frequently, and if you got moved into a cell that didn't have a scratched copy of the tap code somewhere on the walls, that was your it was incumbent upon you to make sure that tap code got scratched in the wall of one of the walls of that cell.
Oh, Merry Christmas! I can't believe you guys did this stuff. They didn't catch this? They didn't pick up on it at all?
They knew we communicated, but they had no idea. We would seldom finish a word. We used abbreviations liberally. And
sort of like Twitter and 45 years ago.
It is. It's like, yeah, exactly. It could be texting on your telephone with all the abbreviations that became standard for texting. We had standard abbreviations for everything that we use in chat code. And you could communicate through the wall almost at the same speed that you'd ever a normal conversation.
Wow.
It was just great.
I've got a question for you from Rod in Colorado. And Rod, welcome to Veterans Radio. You got a question?
Thank you very much, and welcome home, Captain Coffey.
Thank you, Rod. Thanks for calling.
Hey, I am a host and producer of a radio program here in Colorado as well. One part of the POW survival that I'm interested in there at the Hanoi Hilton was the effect that Cubans had. Did you were you ever tortured by Cubans there in during your incarceration there at the Hanoi Hilton?
No, I wasn't. There was a guy from Cuba. We called him Fidel, and he was particularly a nasty individual. He was there sort of on lend lease to the North Vietnamese from another brotherly communist country, of course. And he was brutal. He was assigned to about a group of 20 guys, and you were very unlucky if you happened to be in that group. And he just enjoyed taking out his authority, and he's a big kind of imposing guy, and loved to lord it over the people of whom he was in charge. And he was there for several months. I don't know exactly how long. But one of the guys that he really enjoyed breaking never survived. He drove him out of his mind, and he disappeared. And we were never able to come across him again. And he's attributed for this guy's death.
Certainly. One other question. We had Colonel Ted Guy out here to Colorado just before he passed away back in the mid-90s, and he told us about the fact that he was really disappointed. He was not allowed to see his not allowed to get any information about his debriefs. Are your debriefs still classified?
They may be classified to the general public, but I've had access to mine. The Navy and the Air Force treated that issue, some of these issues, differently, and I can see how that might have been the policy with the Air Force people that he was working with. But the Navy was very forthcoming, and we had access to all of our debriefs and more sometimes. We'd learn things that we had no idea had happened just by going through the records that we had access to.
Also, one more question, please. When I interviewed Admiral Jeremiah Denton, he stressed the point that the code of conduct was valuable during his experience there. Would you agree with that? The adherence to the code of conduct was what got a lot of people through?
Absolutely, the code of conduct. And, you know, the interesting thing was that it meant more and was more helpful the more verbatim you knew the code. And, of course, when you have nothing else to do except consider things like that, you'd analyze the code. And we were fortunate because there are a lot of young Air Force pilots there who were forced to learn the code as a part of their freshman year hazing, actually. And once you learn it, you don't forget it. And it was fresh in their minds. They graduated from the Air Force Academy and maybe had a training tour of several months before coming to Vietnam, and then they were shot down. And so it was fresh in their minds. So they taught all the rest of us the code verbatim. And it meant a great deal more when you learned it verbatim, and because you could understand why every single word was in there.
I know it meant a lot to me when I served there in the mid-60s in the Navy, and I don't know if it means as much to our servicemen and women as it did to me then.
Well, it probably would if we had an opportunity to be POWs, but our current enemy doesn't take prisoners. They just chop off your head.
Okay. Captain Coffey, thank you so much. God bless you, sir, and again, welcome home.
Thank you very much, and GB to you, too.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rod. Thank you very much for calling in. If you'd like to get in and have a question for Captain Coffey, you can give us a call, too, at 877-573-7825. We're going to go into our next break, Captain Coffey, and when we come back, I wanted to talk about your shower experience when we get back. So,
all right.
Keep that thought in mind. You're listening to Veterans Radio. We're talking to Captain Gerald Coffey, the author of the book Beyond Survival. Talks about his experiences of 7 years as a POW in Hanoi. And you're listening to Veterans Radio. We'll be right back.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio talking with Captain Gerald Coffey, author of Beyond Survival. If you'd like to ask him a question, you can call us here at 877-573-7825. I don't want people to get a misunderstanding that you know, your 7 years was all, you know, not fun and games, and, you know, that you guys were communicating and so forth. But you did have one experience where you weren't able to bathe for how long?
Oh, for about 2 months before we were ever able to bathe after being shot down. And, you know, you're so sort of wearing the remnants of either your flight suit or your fatigues that you'd been wearing when you were flying. And you got pretty rank. And I'll tell you, that first availability of to be able to clean yourself up and wash off was just very, very dear. And, you know, after the first couple of months, the guard would take you out of your cell and move you down to old cell number 8, which was the one cell in the, we call a new guy village, where you went through that first thing. And cell number 8 had been converted into a shower. And by that, I mean, they just ran a rusty pipe up one wall and bent it down over the top so the water could run your head. Well, the guard would shove you in there and slam the door and lock it and point to the pipe and say, wash, wash. And you feel about as low as you could possibly feel, because the previous couple of months you've just been through the ringer and you'd been tortured with ropes and interrogation after interrogation after interrogation. And you felt about as low as the rats and the roaches running across the deck there of cell number 8. And eventually you'd strip off the rags you were wearing by this time and turn on the rusty faucet on that old shower and put your hands on the pipe up above your head and let the water run down on your head. And ultimately you glance up, and right there scratched on the wall at eye level by some other American that had been in there first were the words, "Smile, you uncandid camera."
Again, American,
and you couldn't,
American
not,
humor,
you
right?
You couldn't not smile.
Couldn't. And did you ever get new clothing, or did you have to end up wearing your uniform for 7 years?
No, after that initial shower, we got our initial distribution, our allotment of clothing, which included two pair of cotton shorts, two pair of not T-shirts, but the cotton short sleeve shirts, a pair of black rubber tied sandals, and a blue sweatshirt, and a blanket, and a bamboo straw, rice straw mat. You always put down on top of your bunk, which is almost always cement, or sometimes there are wooden slabs that you put down on the floor, and a mosquito net. So so they and when they would hand you this little stack of clothes and so on, and a tin cup, by the way, a tin cup for to drink your water, and they would say something like, "You see, we care for your health." And they had just done your killed you in torture, and there would be inevitably several torture sessions in your future. But when they would give that little stack of clothes, they tried to make it look like our physical well-being was foremost in their mind. And ironically, in a kind of a warped sort of way, it was, because we did represent something of value. They didn't want to lose us for no reason after the initial shoot down and interrogations, but they still took it out on us. So it was a kind of a hollow compliment that we care about your health.
But now, you know, in addition to the physical torture you went through, there was an emotional torture that you would go through, of course. And you were married at the time. How often were you able to communicate with your family, if at all?
Well, over the Dale, I was fortunate because right after I was shot down, they took pictures of me and being captured and being paraded toward Hanoi and so on. So I was a known POW. My face was out there in the world media. A lot of guys were shot down and were just settled right in, closer to Hanoi than you were, and the less time they had to make propaganda hay on you, you got into Wallo with no photographs, and you weren't a known POW. So because I was in the known category, I was allowed to write about as much as anybody was allowed to. But over the 7 years, my wife and I exchanged about a dozen short letters that were written on a on a prepared piece of paper, six lines. You could write six lines, and the letters were just pretty innocuous. You know, if you just say, I'm doing fine, and I love you, and give my love to the kids, and so on. My youngest son, Jerry, was born 2 months after I was shot down. So I didn't even meet him until he was 7 years old when I was finally released. And he lives here in Hawaii and is a very successful young professional and well-known, and he and I just get along great and have a very special relationship. And, of course, because my fate was unknown, my wife named him Gerald Leonard Coffey Jr., the poor kid. So I always point out that we had the same name, but I'm the original, and he always quips rapidly that, yeah, but he's the new and improved version.
That's it. Yes, I can only imagine that. Not being a junior, but
right.
I'm glad that you were able to, you know, I'm just amazed that you're able to maintain such a positive attitude after this whole experience. And I know that I've had the privilege of talking to other POWs, and you all seem to have that same inner strength that probably was helped out by all of those around you.
You're right, Dale. It really was. You know, I attribute my survival to faith in myself, faith in others, starting out with my fellow POWs and my family, of course, faith in our country, and faith in my God. And those four aspects of faith work for me throughout the entire seven-year experience in North Vietnam. But more than that, and I've been a professional speaker for the last 35 years, and in writing in the book, I point out that those same four aspects of faith help us to survive each day right here at home. Mm-hmm. At one time or another, we're all POWs, prisoners of woe. You know, the woe is me type of woe.
Right.
As much as we might wish that we were somewhere else or doing something else or that something hadn't happened to us, for that particular moment, change might not be in the cards. So you simply have to gut it out and get on with your life and make the most of it and try to capitalize on your adversity and learn the lessons that come with adversity. Most Americans, thank God, never have to face something like that. But mm-hmm. without having to face it, you miss out on such a huge slice of life that's very instructional. And I think that's probably one of the most important things that we have in common, we return to POWs, is the knowledge that we can be a lot tougher and endure much more than we would think so otherwise. When I speak, my audiences always come and say and shake their head and say, oh, Calvin Coffey, I would never have been able to get through that. I don't know how you did it. And I said, you get through it exactly the same way that I did. There's nothing extraordinary about me. With the same training and orientation going in, you could survive the same reasons that I did.
I think that's one of the messages that many of us took out of our experience in the military is that can-do attitude that, you know, no matter what the circumstance is, you will be able to get through it. You just have to use your ingenuity and whatever is inside of you and let that come out and just keep plowing forward.
That's exactly right, Dale, and I can't overemphasize the power of the human spirit and the spiritual aspect. My faith in God, the first two English words that I happen to see scratched from the wall of the cell, there were two words with an equal sign between them, and that little formula simply said, God equals strength. God equals strength. And for me, that really worked because I was never, ever totally alone, and I could always find a little bit more strength when I needed it.
Wow. We're running out of time, and this is always annoying when this happens. But we've got about a minute left for you, and I wonder what message would you like to leave with our audience? I know that they can get your book anywhere, pretty much anywhere that they want to. It's called Beyond Survival. But what message would you like to leave with our audience today?
Well, Dale, you've been very generous in mentioning my book, and I appreciate that. And you can get it either at Amazon or you can get it at my website, which is simply www.captaincoffee.com, all spelled out, Captain Coffee. The message I want to leave is that you know, we just need to remember the basics that made our country great. And you know, one presidential term of one individual or another is, you know, we can get through anything that happens.
Mm-hmm.
America truly is unusual, and we have to remember how unique our country is and our basic founding values and principles and help us get this far and we're just all so blessed to be Americans. And, you know, when you see your enemy up close and personal, like we did there in North Vietnam, it makes you appreciate our country all the more because it's based upon truth and justice and freedom and opportunity and creativity And you know, there's just no limit to what a person can achieve in our country, and that's just not true in the vast majority of the rest of the world.
That's true. And to quote Superman, truth, justice, and the American way.
Exactly. Exactly.
Thank you so very much. Mother,
don't forget motherhood and apple pie.
Absolutely. And a good old Chevrolet. thank you very much, Captain Coffey. And we will be talking to you again, and have a great time next week in California.
Dale, thanks so much. I look forward to talking with you again. I really do, and I appreciate that those good wishes. And it's going to be a laugh and scratch kind of reunion, and look around and say, where did all these old guys come from, and who are they? You know, like any reunion. But I'm looking forward. It's going to be great.
Okay. Thank you very much. I just want to remind our audience we'll be back next week with our At Ease program, looking at some books. Rich Atkinson is going to be on talking about the books with World War II, and Dwight Zimmerman will have some other authors. We're going to go out on one of my favorite tunes, and I think a lot of the POW's favorite tunes. It's Kate Smith's God Bless America. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio LLC. The opinions voiced on this program are not necessarily those of this station or Veterans Radio. Until next week, you are dismissed.